Welcome to the Proper Mental Podcast. Normalizing open and honest conversations about mental health by having open and honest conversations about mental health. Hello and welcome to episode 173 of the Proper Mental Podcast, and my guest this week is Gwali Pasale, who is a speaker and a campaigner for refugee rights. And Gwali was sent away from Afghanistan at the age of 12 after his father was killed in a gun battle with the US Army. He was smuggled into Iran and he spent the next 12 months travelling through Europe. He crossed 10 countries, he was put in prison 6 times, and he almost drowned at sea before making it to Britain. And when he arrived, the authorities did not believe he was a child of 13 due to his appearance. And eventually he was fostered, he was sent to a good school, he won a place at a top university, and he was chosen to carry the Olympic torch in 2012. And since then he's done an incredible amount of work, campaigning for refugee rights, working with charities, and using his voice to raise awareness and make change. And in this episode I chat to Gwali about his childhood in Afghanistan, before being forced to leave, and why he was forced to leave. We chat about the impact that living in a war zone had on his mental health, what it was like to flee that war zone to leave his family behind, and we talk about how, when he arrived in the UK, the issues with bureaucracy and isolation and racism just added to the mental health stuff that he was going through at that time. And I suppose this episode is a little different to the usual proper mental format. And it's different in that we don't spend a great deal of time here on Gwali's story. And there's a few reasons for that. The first one is, it's a massive story. We could never do it justice in a single podcast episode. Another reason is that Gwali has written an incredible book. It's called The Lightless Sky, and that's where I found out about him. And it's the story of his life in Afghanistan, and the story of his journey to the UK, and what happened when he got here. It's an incredible read. It's all the things you'd expect. You know, it's sad, it's heartbreaking, it's inspiring. It's a wonderful book. It's not the easiest read. But I suppose more than anything, for me anyway, it was informative. I felt like I learned a lot about the war in Afghanistan, about refugees, about people being displaced. And I'd highly recommend you give it a read. And the third reason that we don't focus too much on that story in this episode is because, although it's an incredible story, it is just one story, and the reality is that there are hundreds of thousands of people around the world who have their own versions of this story. So rather than just focus on one person, I wanted to talk about the wider picture, the realities of being displaced, the realities of being an asylum seeker, everything that comes with that and how that impacts people's mental health. I wanted to break down some of the myths and misunderstanding around refugees. I think people have very strong opinions on this topic, and they're not always based on fact, they're not always based on truth. And I also think that when people talk about asylum seekers, people tend to talk in numbers and about boats and barges and benefits and money. But behind every figure, every statistic is a person with thoughts and feelings and emotions, and who, just like Gwali, probably lived through some horrific experiences. And I wanted to explore the mental health impact of that. It's an episode I've wanted to do for a long time. Me and Gwali first connected about 18 months ago, maybe a bit longer, and it took that long to make this happen. So I'm so grateful to him for his time. And it felt like an important topic to explore. You know, I always think that if you want to find a solution for something, then you have to understand the problem. And I'm not saying Gwali and I solve all the problems and find all the solutions just by having a chat, but it certainly helped me to understand what's going on in the world. And maybe it'll help you to understand a bit more too. In the mental health space, we're all talking about kindness. It's all #be kind, which is great. But that kindness needs to be extended to everyone. We don't get to pick and choose who we get to be kind to. So yeah, huge thank you to Gwali for coming on and guiding me through this complicated and challenging conversation. His book is wonderful. You can get it anywhere. There's links in the episode notes to his socials, to his website, to his TED Talk, which goes into much more detail about his journey from Afghanistan to the UK. And yeah, I hope you enjoyed this conversation. If you would like to watch it, you can do so by becoming a proper mentalist and signing up for the Patreon. It's just an online community. It's £3 a month, And basically, as soon as I record an episode, I throw it up on the Patreon so you can watch it. It's where the videos go. They don't go anywhere else. You get them weeks before they come out on any of the audio platforms as well. And you can do things like connect with other like-minded listeners of the Proper Mental Podcast. You can submit questions for upcoming guests. You can request the videos from any episode in the back catalogue that aren't available anywhere else. And most importantly, you can keep the show going. You can keep it ad-free, sponsor-free, and fully independent. And this is episode 173 of the Proper Mental Podcast with Gawali Prasad. Thank you very much for listening. Enjoy! So this is another episode of the Proper Mental Podcast, and my guest this week is Gawali Prasad. How are you, mate?
I'm good, thank you, Tom. How are you?
I'm good. I'm really good. Mate, this has been a long time in the making, so it's really lovely to sit and have a chat, mate. I really appreciate your time today.
You're welcome. I'm glad to be speaking to you.
I thought probably the best place to start is with yourself, Gawali, right? And that's going to give a lot of background to the conversation that we're going to have. We were just talking actually before I hit record, is that I really want people to go and read your book. So we'll touch on your story today, but if anyone wants the real deep dive into that, that's in the book, right? And that's what the book is there for. We'll see if we can go a bit of a different route maybe with it today. But I think your story kind of sets up so many things that I want to ask you about.
Sure.
And one of the main things that I got from the book really was there's words I'd heard and I didn't know what they meant. And there was, you know, situations that I'd kind of seen on the telly and I didn't really know kind of what was going on and stuff like that. So I thought, it was so useful for me to clear up a lot of this stuff. So I think it'll be really, really useful for people listening to do something similar. And I wondered if we could start where the book starts, really, which is with you as a small child in Afghanistan, because things were pretty good until they weren't, right?
Indeed. So yeah, I think for me, when we had the book idea, we had different way of starting. We started when I'm 11, we started when I'm 10, and then we came to the conclusion it was important to me that we tell the whole story, that I had a life beforehand. It was not just what happened after the invasion of the US and the occupation of Afghanistan and in the killing of my family members and so on. So for me, it was not only relevant, but important and necessary that I provide a perspective from a childhood experience living in the mountains with my grandparents and being a shepherd, and to speak about my family, like my family being doctors and humanitarians and so on. So yeah, that was it was beautiful times, and sadly a lot has happened since then, you know, and as we speak now, the world has changed, but also not changed in some ways. When it comes to Afghanistan, it got put gone back, but the thing that it's been 16, 17 years since I left Afghanistan, and these memories of when I was a child running around in the mountains, 5-6 years old, stays with me, especially now when I see these things on, you know, TikTok and social media. You see these Afghans sharing videos of little shepherds and nomadic people. It really brings back memories. And it's amazing how at the time, you know, I didn't know what an email is and what social media is. And now, look, we live in a world where we can see and people share. It's amazing that people share these videos and stories, documentaries about nomadic people, the lifestyles of Afghans. So perhaps if I was doing what I did like 20 years ago and doing it now, it will be a social media hit, you know. I could be recording myself being in the mountains with the sheep and goats and animals. It would have been great. So it's like, it's amazing how the world has changed in some ways. In some ways, the thing has stayed the same. Like now I see shepherds with smart mobile phones, recording in the mountains of Afghanistan, singing and telling poetries and sharing stories about their animals. It's really wonderful in that sense. But I'm glad I had the childhood that I had, because there are many people who had not experienced what I had experienced, the positive things, as well as the sadly, the negative things of war and conflict and injustices and oppressions and so on.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think, you know, regardless of where people grow up, there's always that, like, it's funny, isn't it, the relationship with social media and and how people use it now. But yeah, the idea that there's people out there, shepherds in the mountain and putting it on TikTok, that's like quite a wild idea to me. Yeah, that's funny. Yeah.
Indeed.
And so obviously back then that was, you mentioned, like, before the kind of the invasion, and the Taliban were in charge, right? And something that really kind of I wasn't expecting, when I read your book, was that there was an element of sort of, like, peace and happiness all in that peace. Like, you guys were getting on, getting on all right, really, like, considering all the things, because we, it, Taliban is one of those words, right? And we think it means all these different things, and most people in this country and most white people don't have a really have a clue about the history and the politics and all that sort of stuff. But it was, even after, yeah, I mean, it was kind of like, again, it was okay, wasn't it, for you guys?
Exactly. So right now, as we speak, my brother, my family, a lot of my relatives are very happy with the Taliban. I'm not happy because I have a Western view of things. I've been influenced by the West. You know, for me, I value freedom and opportunities and being able to vote, have a say, all these things. Like, so for a lot of Afghans, so I will come to, but I went back to Afghanistan after 16 years to see my mother and my family. And it struck me, like, the Taliban were back. And it feels really strange because I was like, you know, when I left the country, it was a different situation. This is like when I was a child. So Taliban are pretty much the same. They have evolved in terms of the technological advance. Like, I mean, they are very against mobile phones and stuff. Now they are making the most of it. They're using it for their propaganda. So it's crazy, as we're saying, like social media and media. So for a lot of Afghans that I spoke to, particularly in districts and villages in rural Afghanistan, they were like, we couldn't care less who is the government. We don't care the Taliban or the Republic or whether you call it Emirates or whether you call it whatever you want to call it, as long as we're safe, as long as we're able to harvest food and vegetations and our properties protected, our children could go to school, we could have access to basic services like healthcare and so on and so forth. And the most important of all, there is safety and security. I don't care. And they were telling me, like, what did the President Ghani did for me? What did President Karzai? What did the Republic do for me? You know, I couldn't travel from a village to village. I couldn't travel to my to the homeland or to the district of my parents. So my brother was actually telling me that he weren't able to visit our grandparents' home or district and village for the last 15 years. But the funny thing is, it was because of these guys who are now in charge. He weren't able to go. Now he's able to go even at night because of this guy. So there's a really strange situation where you look at it, they're like, oh, look, we have brought us peace and security, but you guys were the one doing the suicide bombing. You guys were the one who were causing the insecurity. And so it's they're taking credit for something basically by all they're doing is by not doing the thing they used to do. Yes, there were insecurity, of course, from the Afghan government side and from the Afghan army and so on and so forth. So I'm in a, you know, 20 years down the line, the thing that makes me angry is that what was the point of the invasion and occupation? I mean, of course, I was against it. I'm still against it that the US went into Afghanistan the way it did. And now how they're now, for example, they're bombing Yemen right now as we speak. And the situation with Iraq and Syria and elsewhere in Libya we saw and, you know, other places like Somalia and so on and so forth. So for me, we lost 170, 190,000, almost 200,000 Afghans in 20 years. For what? Billions and trillions were spent. And now we were abandoned and betrayed. The Afghans were basically left to the wolves. The US made a deal with the Taliban, its enemy. So the Afghan soldiers who lost about 75,000 or so soldiers in 20 years of, you know, fighting so-called terrorism and the Taliban, the US just literally made deals with them. So they're like, what are we sacrificing? So they give up. I mean, we lost the country. Of course, things weren't great in terms of like corruption and there were a lot of oppression going on and warlords were empowered. Parliamentarians were people who were supposed to be in Hague for war crimes, but they were actually governing. They were vice presidents, you know, they were ministers. So anyway, in a way that it's good that the government collapsed, but we have lost so much progress when it comes to women rights and girls' education. And there were, of course, a lot good done, although for me, this idea, like, you know, the British Empire was great because it built railways, it built this, it built that. Yes, they may have done some good work, but the idea of empire in itself is wrong because this idea that you are inferior, we need to come in and civilize you, and we need to, you had to be under our so-called subject, you had to be subject and protected, and so on and so forth. So, although the occupation of Afghanistan and the invasion had really maybe positive results for girls' educations and women's rights and so on, that doesn't diminish the fact. It was wrong in the first place. It was immoral and cruel to invade Afghanistan and to occupy it. Yes, the Taliban were bad, but then Why, if they were bad, why then 20 years down the lane, they became so-called the good guys? Like the US literally legitimized them and give them the sense of a government in waiting. So yeah, I could go on and on about politics. So yeah, it was really an interesting contrast when I went back and I saw, okay, you know, there was peace and security, but people were hungry. People were starving. Literally 24 million Afghans, almost over half of the population, don't have enough to eat. They don't know where their next meal is coming from. The UN food program is saying we need £5 billion to feed families. Last year they were supporting about 28 million. This year is about 24 million. Most Afghans are daily laborers. They're farmers. We had the worst droughts in 37 years. We had the worst flooding. We had the worst earthquake. And so there would be natural disasters, and we had the collapse of the government, and people have lost jobs. People have lost money. The educated have left the country. Like, we're in a very strange and bizarre situation. And so, yes, there is security and peace through an iron stick. And again, these guys are now in charge, the guys who are causing insecurity. So it needs to be, in some sense, like, yeah, thank you for not doing suicide bombing. Thank you for not blowing things up. And thank you for, like, not, you know, sending rockets and so on and so forth. But at the same time, the main concern right now is forget about democracy and freedom and so on and so forth. These values that we things are important. Afghans just want to be able to feed their families. And they, you know, there's sanctions on the country that were reserved, taken by the US and frozen. So there's just so much wrong. And so it makes me really upset that we are in 2024. Although the US were happy to deal with the Taliban and make peace with them and make agreements with them. And then now Afghans are punished for their decision. I just don't get it. Like, the Afghans did not elect the Taliban. We had no say in it. The US imposed them on us. I mean, they were actually supported in the first place when they came in 1994 through Pakistan and Saudi and other countries. And the US were kind of supporting them as part of the kind of the Mujahideen and so on. But ultimately, they were imposed on us in 2021. And now the Afghans are the ones who are branding the impact of it all. The US just walked away. The West just, as I said, you know, abandoned and betrayed Afghanistan and Afghans. And I think it's unforgivable.
Yeah, such a mess, mate, such a mess. And like you say, the basic human rights, isn't it? It's safety and having something to eat and being cared for and stuff like that. And it's really sounds so messy, mate. So messy. I want to kind of rewind a little bit, mate, to you setting off on your journey to come over here. And how did you come to, you know, start that journey to get to the UK?
So, you know, I mean, as I said, the Lightless Guy has the full story, but just to give you a brief summary. So in 2005, sadly, my members of my family were killed by the US forces, allegedly thinking that we had linked to the Taliban, which we did. But my father was a doctor. We had a standing in the community. My uncles were previously involved with the Taliban. And then, you know, a lot of Afghans were killed. Just the US could make any excuse for killing you. And then, you know, so yeah, sadly, when your family members get killed, there's very little you could do. There's no justice. You can't seek justice because, you know, the more you try to find justice, you could actually, you know, you could be a target, which we became a target to the for the US, for the Afghan government. And by the Taliban wanted to recruit us to fight not only a holy war and take revenge for our family members to free the country from the invaders. We were children, but I was very keen on the idea of fighting, not only to take revenge for my family members, but also to free Afghanistan. It was important to me growing up that we fought the British three times. We fought the Russians, and even before that, Alexander the Great and Genghis Khan and so on. So Afghans have this, I mean, the Taliban used to tell the West that, you know, you have the watches and we have the time. That's exactly what happened, you know. And it's sad what happened. It should not have happened. But anyway, so we left because of the war and the conflict, and our family sent us away to Europe for our safety. The journey was a lot complicated. They paid a lot of money to smuggle us to get me and my brother out of the country in 2006. I was about age 12. My brother was 13, 14. Me and him were separated by the smugglers, and I didn't see him for the next 14 months. I had to travel on my own across multiple countries, about 10 countries. And I was arrested, sent back and forth, deported, treated quite badly by authorities in Turkey, in Bulgaria, in Iran, in Greece, as well as France and elsewhere. I had a terrible time in Calais, across the Mediterranean. It took me a year. The journey between Afghanistan and Britain is about 5,000 miles, but it took me 12,000 miles or so because of the back and forth and being deported from Turkey to Iran, from Bulgaria to Turkey, and then, you know, from just, then starting all over again. It's crazy, man. Traveling across Turkey is like 2,000 miles or something. So anyhow, it was a long journey. It was exhausting physically and mentally and emotionally, being a child and being on this journey, trying to seek protection and safety. So yeah, England or Britain wasn't my target, but I found out on the way that my brother was here. So I continued. And also I was unwelcomed elsewhere except Italy, where I could have stayed. And, you know, you hear people say, oh, if these guys are genuine refugees, why are they coming to the UK? They should have stayed in the first safe country. Well, in fact, Pakistan and Iran have been hosting 5 million Afghan refugees for the last 40 plus years. Yes, they have very few rights when it comes to education, healthcare, and citizenship and so on, and work and employment. But they've been, you know, been hosted. And recently, Pakistan were threatening, actually, they have actioned it to send 1.7 million undocumented refugees, Afghans. So yeah, in Pakistan, Iran randomly, I mean, all the time, uses Afghans as a pawn. Like whenever they have issue with Afghanistan or with the Taliban or with the previous government, they use the refugees as a political tool. So, and also this issue, people do stay in the safe country. So like for safe countries, a lot of people do stay in France or Italy or Greece or Turkey, whatever they're able to, if they're able to claim asylum. So small numbers comes here and they have their reasons. So, and also there's nothing in international law which says you have to stay in the first safe country. So Tom, if you're fleeing the UK for whatever reason, you will want to go where you know, you have connection, you have links, you have friends, you have families, you have, you know, the language or know the culture, whatever. Like, you know, we used to get about 30,000 asylum applications since I've been here every year. France has been getting three times of that, four times of that, 100,000. Germany have been getting seven times more. So we need to put things into perspective. So for me, when I tell my story, it's important that I put it into context now that, you know, yes, recently we've been getting 70,000, 75,000, 6,000 asylum applications. The more, you know, the more hostile policies and law we have, the more deterrence we try to come up with, the more people comes, you know. So the small boat situation, the hotels usage, it's all of government's own doing. It's like, you know, it's not that we have a huge numbers of people. I mean, France could do more, obviously. Germany could do more. And I mean, Sweden, Spain, Italy, they all do more than us in Greece. Why shouldn't we be sharing the burden? Because we're the furthest. And actually, we have caused a lot of these conflicts in the first place. Britain has been, you know, stalking. Like, for example, if a Yemeni comes here, we'll penalize them and criminalize them for coming here. But we are happy to bomb them. We are happy to give Saudi the weapons to bomb them. Same situation with the Palestinians, you know, and as well as the Afghans, the Iraqis, the Syrians, elsewhere in the world, in Sudan, there's so many conflicts happening. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, we need to explain to people that people have a right to claim asylum, although the government has criminalized it. Nevertheless, in international law, everybody have a right to claim asylum, whatever they feel safe or whatever they want to go. And they have to explain themselves and present themselves. And the government could obviously have the right to reject that and refuse that, which the UK government has been doing for years. Afghans had about 50-60% rejection rates for the last 20 years. But suddenly, because of the Taliban takeover, I have friends, I know people who got their documents after 10 years, 15 years. And then, I mean, the UK hosts less than 1% of the world refugees. We are not in the top 10. We are not in the top 20. Even not only in the world, but not even in Europe. You know, Germany is hosting over a million Syrians, over a million Ukrainians. I mean, this issue of safe countries, why are the Ukrainians leaving Romania and Poland, they're safe countries? Nobody says a thing. I mean, it's great. As a refugee rights campaigner, as a humanitarian, I have been in Poland last year. I was in Kharkov. I missed a flight from Denmark and I had to go all the way to Kharkov, which was a nice city. But the flight to the UK was full of Ukrainian families. I was very touched. I was very pleased. And same thing happened. I visited Moldova. I work with a charity. I'm a trustee for a charity. We work in Moldova with Ukrainian refugees. And I saw the plane again full of Ukrainian refugees, and all they had to show was passport, a ticket, and a letter from the Home Office saying they don't need a visa. That is not available to anybody else. So why are we able to do this for Ukrainians but not for Afghans or for others? We have the Afghan resettlement scheme, which is a joke. It's in name only. Only a few dozen people came through it. There are literally thousands of Afghans waiting in Iran, in Pakistan, in Uzbekistan, in Dubai, and elsewhere in Turkey, who have visas, but they can't come because we have such a mess. We have made a mess of the system. We had 20,000 Afghans staying in hotels for 2 years, costing us $1 million a day. So this government, we are blaming the wrong people for the mess. I mean, the asylum seekers in hotels, I could go on and on, but the asylum seekers costing us £8 million a day. It's not because the asylum seekers want to be in this hotel. They're terrible. You and me will not stay in most of these hotels. The border inspector says, not only are they inadequate, the asylum accommodation is inadequate and it's not fit for purpose. But this money is not money that could be used for schools, or you know, the government say, oh, we could use this money for schools or healthcare. This money is actually the foreign aid budget that they've been using, which should be actually sent to Afghanistan, Syria, Sudan, Eritrea, whatever, like place where there's conflicts, Yemen and so on, and Palestine. And but they're using the foreign aid budget, somehow they're able to justify it because they're helping, you know, asylum seekers and refugees. The asylum seekers doesn't want to be in a hotel. The Home Office doesn't want them in a hotel, but they're there because of the inefficiency, the incompetence of the government for not making quicker and better decisions and keeping people in limbo. And we have the Borders and Nationality Act, which basically creates a two-tier system of good refugees and bad refugees, the deserving and undeserving. And then Priti Patel said it's going to solve all the asylum problem. It's broken. It's going to fix it. The new migration plan. And then Suella Braverman came and said, no, we need to do something better, something even more extreme. Let's have the illegal migration bill, ban asylum altogether. Why do we have a two group of good and bad refugees? Let's ban the whole refugees together. Everybody who comes here irregularly or so-called illegally will not be allowed. And then there is no alternative. So we were supposed to send people to Rwanda. We spent millions in, I don't know, 300 million or something to send people to Rwanda. Nobody has been sent. This was supposed to be a deterrent, but Rwanda is at the same time a safe and wonderful country. So it's just like, it's mind-blowing. I mean, it's mind-blowing. Like this whole thing about deterrence and hostility, like the time and money and energy we spend on this, we could be actually helping people through solidarity, through compassion, through burden sharing, through responsibility sharing, through being kind and welcoming. I had people come tell me, especially politicians in Kulwali, if you are welcoming, wouldn't more people will come? I said, well, you've been unwelcoming for 20 years and people still come. So may as well change the tactic and be welcoming and be kind. The language of the right wing, the fascist, has become mainstream, not only language, but policies and laws. When I come to this country, it was a culture of disbelief and dehumanization and criminalization. But now it's actually the law of the land. So we have about 30,000 people right now in the asylum system who are in limbo. We can't send them anywhere, which we shouldn't be sending them. That's cruel in itself and immoral and wrong. But at the same time, they're just there somewhere sitting in a military barricades or in badges or whatever, costing us, I don't know, as I, you know, millions a day. For what?
Oh, mate, it's, you know, crikey, where to even start? You know, I suppose what's interesting to me in amongst all that is you as a campaigner and as a humanitarian and the work that you do. How am I going to say this? How does the impact on you working in this space, right? Because it's so frustrating. It's such a mess. The people who are supposed to care don't care. There's so much like hate and strong opinions based on misinformation and lies. So, you know, people like yourself, and, you know, I'm not asking you to speak on behalf of anyone else who does the work that you do, but how do you keep going with it? How do you, like, what's the, you know, I don't even know what I'm asking here, Gwali. I think you
That's
know
a
what I'm getting
question,
at.
Tom, but... I appreciate what you're saying, because sometimes I just wish I wasn't doing this, because when I had the chance to do my politics and social science degree, I wanted to become a politician, maybe go to Afghanistan, become an ambassador, become an MP or whatnot. And then I did my master's in good governance and so on. Sometimes I just wonder I shouldn't be doing what I'm doing, because it's really mentally difficult, like physically also, because I've been doing this for the last 10 years, and there have been campaigns around like family reunification, campaigns on lifting the ban, allowing asylum seekers to work. You know, asylum seekers live on 560 a day. I mean, I just went this morning, got a coffee in a cake. It was like £8. How do you live? How do you expect people? So I have an asylum seeker friend who lives in Kurby. I live in Northamptonshire. He lives in Kurby, about 20 minutes away. He takes the bus to college. That basically is like £5 or £4. And the guys in the hotel, they get about £8 a week, so £1 a day. And they get about £39 or £37 a week or something. It's crazy. And we were asking that they should allow people to work. And then, although in theory, I'm against the idea, because, I mean, in practice, in theory, I support it. In practice, I feel like it would be better to make quicker decision rather than creating more bureaucracy. But I supported the campaign, which was a good campaign, a good cause to allow the asylum seekers to work and lift the ban. And there was a campaign on ending detention. We're the only country in Europe where we detain people indefinitely, asylum seekers. And now we're going to not only detain people indefinitely, we're going to detain everyone. And then we had other campaigns to, you know, to show solidarity and increase support to funding for English classes and so on. So for me, like, I sometimes think, you know, I haven't seen no positive improvement. What am I doing this? Like, why? But then when I visit school, when I do talks and raise awareness and speak to young people, try to empower them, inspire them, I want young people to be concerned citizens. I want young people to understand and feel you know, show solidarity with what's happening, let's say, in Gaza, in Afghanistan? What kind of a human are we when we don't show emotions, when we don't show, you know, when we don't stand for justice? What I'm doing, I feel like it's necessary, it's important, and somebody got to do it. There are very few, like, I have so many friends that tell me, well, I just get a normal job. Like, why are you doing this? Like, why are you, like, you know, impacting? I have a family, I had to pay bills and rents, and, you know, sometimes a lot of the time I do a lot of, like, charitable work, and it's like, you know, it's just not sustainable financially. And then if I get a job, I wouldn't have the availability and flexibility to be able to travel and do talks. So, I mean, I enjoy being able to have a voice and use my platform, and but then it's tiring. It really is. And I do sometimes, you know, think about considering that I should just quit and just live a normal life. Like, you know, the 100 million displaced people in the world, over 100 million, 40, 50 million are refugees. This problem is keep getting worse. And we are not finding positive, we're not finding realistic solution to this. And, you know, I as a person with lived experience, the government should be speaking to people like me to trying to say, look, what can we do? How do we help people? How do we have a more a sustainable way of supporting people with a humane approach? This hostility, this deterrence, I mean, sometimes people say, oh, we don't want people to die in the channel. Well, that's precisely what our laws and policies are doing. You know, like, let's have alternative. Let's have a way where we welcome people. We have safer and legal routes. We have, you know, protection. And yeah, so the question you're asking me is an important one. And I feel like I have very few, there's only very few refugee rights campaigners, advocates and activists doing it for longer. Only everybody seems to quit it because it's just impossible. It takes a toll on your mental health. It takes a toll on you. But the positive aspect for me is, like, I get to travel. I get to meet people. And I see that there are a lot of good people with good hearts and they want to help. I see that, you know, there was the campaign against the lifeboat, the NRLI. And Nigel Farage is calling it a taxi for illegal migrants or whatnot. And then the public came to its rescue and donated millions and millions of pounds to it. So, you know, there's a lot of positive stories. And again, when I travel, I see the good work been happening, people fostering unaccompanied minors. And I hear stories of success of refugees opening businesses and being welcome in their communities and having children, their families, and the friendship they're building. I see people mentoring and befriending refugees and helping them. Like, you know, a lot of people has helped me too. So I do what I do because I feel there's a moral duty. And people need to be informed. People need to be aware. If they don't want to listen to me, fine, but I should be there. My voice should be there, and they have no excuse. I will speak if people want to hear me or not. I will, you know, I hope people will hear me. And I see people do hear me, and I'm happy for people to disagree with me and challenge me. But at the same time, I really want people to realize there is no excuse. We need to be concerned citizens. We need to be caring. Otherwise, where is our humanity? If you're not able to help refugees, like the housing crisis, the cost of living crisis, whatnot, we're blaming the wrong people. We're scapegoating refugees and asylum seekers for the incompetence and wrong decision of this government. We saw with Liz Truss making crazy decisions, and literally half of the country's economy was gone in a day, and nothing happens to her. And then everybody's blaming asylum seekers. Like, really? Come on. Are we the Brexit was a big thing. Leaving the European Union, we left the European Union, our problem has doubled. And now, like, let's completely stop refugees. You will still not be able to get a social housing. You will still not be able to get a doctor appointment. You will still not be able to get a school placement. You will still have struggles with the cost of living. You will still, actually, you will have less doctors. You will have less people working in your farms or whatever. Like, we had fruits and vegetables got roasted because nobody was picking them because we stopped the Europeans from coming just after Brexit. And so, you know, the question was something else, but I answered it entirely differently. Ultimately, I feel like being an activist is not easy, and especially when you don't see any progress. The only positive I see is the public. I think there are a lot of good in this country. But the thing that worries me is how government is using this issue of refugees for election, and how, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if the Conservative completely based the whole thing on Rwanda and illegal migration and this and that. And, you know, try to win this election. Like, this, we're a pawn. Like, come on, man. I'm supposedly a threat. I should be sent 6,000 miles away. And, like, this is not how things work. This is not how international law works. The conventions on refugees and the conventions on preventions of torture and all other human rights that we have. Like, if they target, take my human rights away, they will take your human rights away at some point. Like, this idea, like, the government has been passing laws again, like, policing, reducing, people can't protest, people can't make noises, and all sorts of crazy things limiting people's freedom. So Yeah, I just want people to wake up and, you know, really understand that the government is blaming us for its failures and that we need to be making our politician accountable. I met my MP a few times and I told him, why are you voting for this bill? Why? He's like, oh, this is what my constituents want and I know this is going to solve the problems, make their life better. I said, well, yeah, they send it to parliament to help them make their life better, but I can guarantee you this will cause more problem and suffering, not only for the refugees and asylum seekers, but even for your constituents. It's not going to solve any problems. You know, people will still have the issue of shortage of houses. People will still have all these issues that we all have as citizens or non-citizens, you know. We need to invest in housing. We need to invest in healthcare and so on and so forth. We have an aging population. We should be actually welcoming these young asylum seekers. All of my friends, honestly, like the people that I know, they came with me. I have a friend, Sahil. He's a scientist. He's teaching doctors and nurses how to do operations in operation theaters, surgeons in hospitals. I have friends who runs restaurants. I have friends who have businesses, who have pawn shops, who have car washes, who have takeaways, who I have friends who are doctors, who are accountants, who are engineers, literally. I have a friend who, I have a friend, they're four, eight brothers. They're all doing, you know, some are in the police, some are doctors, some are engineers, some are doing business. Like, they're contributing to this society. They're part of this society. But then, like, we're blaming, yes, we may have a few lazy ones. That's, we are humans. And again, refugees, we are held to a high standard. We can't afford to make mistakes. We have to say, look, we are contributing. That's why you should welcome us. But I said to people, look, we should not welcome refugees because they contribute. They will do that anyway. We should welcome them because it's the right thing to do. We must be taking our fair share. We can't like lecture other countries when we are sending ours to Rwanda to deter people. I don't get it. Like how these people come up with these kind of laws and policies that Rwanda is unsafe. The Supreme Court said it's unsafe, but then we're going to pass a legislation, a law in the parliament to say it's safe. Like, how does that make sense? How does it work? And my argument has been, okay, Rwanda is amazing. Rwanda is safe. We should still not be sending refugees there. It's not their responsibility. They already host more refugees than we do.
I suppose, you know, the frustration with all of that. And then you think about these big problems, they don't get solved overnight, really, you know. And with you going to schools and speaking to young people, that's ultimately what's going to make the difference, isn't it, as mm-hmm. we go on, because they're the people, they're the next generation that are going to be, you know, doing the right things and making the difference. And I really do, I have a lot of hope when I think about the younger generations, you know. I kind of, even when you look, even like social media, when people are all just like arguing and bickering and being hateful in like the comments, they're all middle-aged people, right? The young people aren't getting involved in that. There's a real different mindset, isn't it? And I suppose that it adds an element of, you know, like there's that side of your work, right? It's passing that torch forward and carrying the work on.
It gives me hope. And I think we need to get the young people to be educated and to be aware of their responsibility now and as well as in the future, you know. But I have people tell me, like, you know, my family has like racist views and so on and so forth, challenging these views and making a stand. You know, there's a verse in the Quran that says that you should make a stand for justice, even if it's your own father. And even if your voice shake, you should speak up and, you know, be counted. So, yeah, speaking to young people and speaking to universities and speaking to whomever who wants to listen and wants to understand the experience of refugees. And I feel like because there are so many asylum seekers in refugees who just want to live, they don't want to be like sharing their stories of struggles and hardships and difficulties. And I'm able to do that. And especially with the book, has given me a chance to travel to like 25 countries, to do like 500, 600 talks, to go everywhere in the UK. I love the traveling aspect, not so much the sharing of the story. But again, I think it's been good for me, you know, raising awareness and meeting people and learning. So yeah, there is of course positive to that side for me as well. But at the same time, it's exhausting, it's difficult, and then you don't see much change. It's all about challenging. Like recently, there was a new report that the Home Office put 1,000 unaccompanied minors, children, in adults' accommodation in detention facilities. So we're like we the Home Office sees almost everyone as lying, as a suspect. You know, I have a friend Shafiq who was in prison for illegal entry for 12 months. So when people say, oh, let's imprison them, well, actually, that's already happening. People are being imprisoned without arriving, without a passport or whatever, like all sorts of crazy excuses. We have laws where we used to criminalize people culturally and, you know, treat them as criminals and penalize them. But now we have laws. And it's crazy to think, you know, in 2020, in 21st century, in 2024, or, you know, we're at a stage where we are dehumanizing our fellow human beings because of their nationality, because of where they're coming from, rather than understanding the situation and trying to help them. You know, I understand, although I disagree with deportation and detention and so on and so forth, but there has to be a system in place. The system is broken, but asylum seekers and refugees are not the one who broke it. It's the government who broke it. The former immigration minister, Robert Jenrick, he said, the reason we're not making faster decisions because more people will come. So the reason there's a big backlog of 170,000 people, that's deliberately done to get people not to come, but people still come. So what do you do? And then it costs £8 million. That money we could be spending on foreign aid, we are spending on hotels, you know? And these hotels, honestly, as I said, no, we wouldn't stay in it. These hotels are terrible. The food is terrible. So it's not like, oh, for example, I'm a citizen and I'm struggling and I see a hotel. Guys are getting like this idea of 5-star hotels and food. Even if they're getting a basic hotel, it makes me angry. So the government wants us to be angry, to show, look, we saw the riots in Knowsley, in Liverpool, and of course the right wing and the fascists will take advantage of that. But ultimately, ordinary people say, look, I'm like struggling to pay bills and rents, like in my personal capacity. And then I see asylum seekers getting things for free. Of course, that'll make me angry. But without understanding the context, without knowing, you know, why they're there, how they're there. So we need to, the government needs to explain to the public, you know, why we welcome people, how we're welcoming them, and when we're not welcoming them, how we're removing them. We need to be doing it in the most humane way possible. You know, if we need to remove people, we need to remove people, but do it in the way that is humane and compassionate. And, you know, like, of course, I get it. Like, we have to have a system, an immigration system that works. But ultimately, this idea, oh, we get too many people. Oh, students should not bring their spouses. Healthcare workers should not bring their spouses in dependents. Like, come on. The UK universities literally contribute billions and billions to the economy. And why would I come and study here if I'm a Chinese or Indian student if I can't bring my dependents with me? Why would I want to stay here? Why would I want to work here? Why would I, like, the government just like, yeah, this, they have an obsession with immigrations and legal migration or irregular migration or so-called illegal migration, which is dehumanizing terminology, but you know, irregular migration or people who come here and become undocumented and so on and so forth. It's like, come on, focus on the real issue. These are not even issues, man.
Yeah, well, a good way to get people to do what you want them to do is to make them afraid, right?
Yeah.
So that's how, that's that sort of that right-wing narrative, you know, it's divide and conquer, isn't it? And that's been a right-wing tactic forever. That's kind of how that operates, isn't it? Is splitting people through fear, you know? And no, you know, I'm really conscious of your time today, Gwali, because this time is flying by, and I know you've got things to do, mate. But I did want to kind of touch on the mental health aspect of people coming to this country, you know. And we talked about yours as a campaigner, but when you look at your story that you detail in the book, it was after everything that happened and all the terrible things, but it was only kind of once you got here and everything stopped that the real impact seemed to like take its toll. And that the mental health side of things is something that never really gets talked about, right? We talk about money, we talk about numbers, we talk about boats, but it's all very dehumanizing, right? People don't think of numbers as individual people who go through whatever they do to come to this country. And then there's just paperwork and, you know, hunger and hatred, you know, and that it was that part of your book really that I kind of wanted to just before we go to dig into a little bit, because that seemed to be when you really started to struggle more mentally with everything.
Great. Yes. I've been campaigning on this issue of mental health. Of course, there's a mental health crisis in this country, especially for young people. But when it comes to asylum seekers and refugees, I can guarantee you for sure that almost all of us have mental health issues and emotional issues and anxieties and depression and PTSD and other mental health implications because of our experiences, not only of the journey, but also growing up in war zones. You know, when I see the images from Gaza, not as a parent, but not only just as a parent, but as a growing up in a war zone, you know, I have many, many sleepless nights. And it really brings nightmares. It brings me really terrible memories. So there is no support, very little support available. The NHS is struggling and the support that is available for mental health is not fit for purpose in terms of like, it's not culturally appropriate. A lot of Afghans or others were not even like, oh, it's like, they go through things, they're like, oh, it's life, you know, everyone goes through it. They don't even realize that they need to go and, you know, seek help. They feel ashamed of being weak and non-mindly or enough or whatever, of not being strong enough. So, you know, my brother has gone through a lot of struggles with mental health. Many of my friends, myself, I went through, got some counseling, which was not helpful, very helpful. But I feel like I've been advocating for getting young asylum seekers and refugees to go out there, to go to the countryside and spend time with people and, you know, really for them to have advocates for them to have befrienders and mentors who they could catch up with, because a lot of these guys are isolated, are sent to really terrible housing situation. Their legal status sometimes takes years and years. They're in limbo, and all these things impact you. So, you know, you're here, you're physically safe maybe, but you're kept in a badge, and and then you think, why am I in a badge? Because you are unwanted on this land. They want you to be away from the public, away from society. And so, yeah, these asylum seekers. I have friends who are really, I had a friend who were actually in a badge, came here as a student and was sent to the badge in Dorset. And he could try to explain things to me. I could understand him, but I need, like, he was like, I can't even explain to people how it feels. Yes, it's a nice place. It's better than the hotel, but why are we kept here? Why have we been sent here? Just, they want to make an example of us for what? Why are they doing this to us? We have already struggled. We have already gone through so much violence and pain. And so mental health is a real issue. And I think, I hope more attention and resources could be, more attention could be paid to it and more resources put into it. I've seen some good work being done in Wales, in Scotland, and elsewhere, specifically by Public Health England, Public Health Authorities, and as well as by Public Health England and other places. But more could be done to target these guys and help them. But the main issue is, like, sometimes no matter how much counseling you provide or how much early intervention support you provide, if people don't have adequate accommodation, if people don't have enough to eat, if people don't have their legal status, they've been told that we're going to send you to Rwanda, or, you know, we can try to send it to anywhere where they will have you. There's the thing called a third country unit. So a lot of guys have been sent letters saying you are in a third country unit. We're going to decide whether we will assess your asylum here or we'll send you somewhere else. Although the Home Office knows full well, they can't send people to anywhere. Like, even if people have traveled through France, they decide, yeah, if you can't travel through safe countries, then we're going to try to send you back there. But France, why would France have anyone? Why would Italy and other? So even though the Home Office and the government knows that they will not be sending anyone anywhere, but they want to tell you that any case. So I have people call me crying, saying, what do I do? Should I run away? They told me that they're going to try to send me to Austria, Czech Republic, Slovenia, Bulgaria, because I crossed those countries. I'm like, don't worry, they're not going to send you anywhere. These countries will not have you anyway. So, like, but this, the Home Office, the mental health of people have been worsened by the decisions and policies and laws of the Home Office in this country. So not only not we, imagine, bro, like, not only we're not helping people, we're making it worse for them. You know, we saw somebody committed suicide in the badge. I just remember that. You know, a young Albanian, like, Albanian have been dehumanized so much that people don't even care. We see people drowning in the channel. We see people want to commit suicide because of there was a hunger protest in one of the old military barracks in base. Like, really, this, the way we treat people, and in my book, I explain, I committed suicide twice because of the way I was treated by the Home Office and Social Services. Not of anything else. So we are at a stage where this country not only not supporting people to overcome their PTSD and emotional well-being and mental health, instead of providing services and support, we make their life hell. We make it worse. So that's where we are. With the laws that we have, the policy we have, we keep people in limbo. We keep them in detention after going through all the ordeal they have gone through. Like, I honestly don't get it. Like, why are we doing this to people? How do we expect these people to contribute? How do you expect them in the future to love this country? Really, the more you welcome people, the more they will love this country. They will do the best they can to protect it and contribute to it. Like, you know, there are people who I know who has not contributed to society, who said, I tell them, I was like, why? They said, well, this country has made my life hell for 10 years. Why should I contribute? And they tell me, look, they tell me, well, of course, we will not cause harm, but we will not do any good as well. I will not pay tax. I will just, like, not be a productive citizen. I will not be voting. What is the point? I will not be, like, I had friends tell me this in Bolton, where I used to live. They're like, you know, yeah, because of what we have experienced, what the Home Office in the country has put us through, why should I even care?
And, you know, I get that. That makes sense, right? Yeah, why? You know? Yeah. Yeah. Oh, mate, it's complicated. But, yeah, and I don't know. It's so beneficial for me to read your book and to talk to you, right? And to learn more. And I think that's kind of where it starts, isn't it, for people to, if you want to be more compassionate about a situation and, you know, be more open-hearted towards a situation, then, like, you know, making a bit of effort to kind of understand it and
yeah, that's what I'm asking for. Look, I'm not asking for, like, it would be great if people open their homes to refugees and host them through, like, the charity Refugees Are Home and Rooms for Refugees, like the people have hosted Ukrainians. That would be great. or to foster them or to befriend and mentor them. But all I'm asking for is to have an open heart, to have an open mind, to be compassionate, to be kind, and to show solidarity. Yes, if, like, for example, right now, I can't help refugees. Let's say I can't help refugees, but I shouldn't be racist. I shouldn't be mean to them. Okay, fine, you can't help. Or you might have like strange views. Keep it to yourself or try to educate yourself. And just don't blame us. Don't scapegoat us for, like, you know, we already have our own struggles. You know, the thing is, it makes such a difference. I catch up with my foster carers yesterday after a long time for a coffee. I visited Bolton. I live 2.5 hours away now. It was so wonderful. Like, this person have changed my life. I lived with him for 2 years, provided me warmth, home, and love. It's like, come on, you could do, we all have the capability and capacity to do good, to touch people's lives. Why are we doing it? Like, this person, I didn't knew he was my foster carer, and he helped me with my GCSEs, he helped me with my immigration status, he helped me with my mental health, he helped me with my work, he helped me with my life, he helped me with housing, he helped me with, like, support me, you know? And after 10 years, we're still friends. We're like a family, you know? That 2 years had such an impact. He could have refused to take me. He could have, he didn't have to do, like, the things, he went an extra mile. It was not part of his duties as a foster care. He could have just, like, passed me on to social workers and to lawyers and somebody else. But no, he made an effort. And so, like, all of us, so whenever I see people who are going through tough times or who have age disputes, who have other issues, I try to help them. But such a mess, there's just so much. So yeah, all of us are able to help. All of us are capable to support refugees and asylum seekers. And the least I'm asking is, if you're not going to support us or support people who are fleeing violence and persecution and injustice, don't make their life more difficult.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, mate, that's very beautifully put, Gwali. And yeah, I knew you were going to give me a lot to think about today, and you really have. And I'm just, yeah, thank you so much for coming on, mate. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me. And I hope people listen, and I hope people pass on, you know, share the information and hopefully read the book. There's so many refugees books out there and their stories. And of course, my story is not just like being a victim and sad story. It's funny. It's humorous. It's an experience of my life. There's like 20 years of my life in there. And so, like, you know, I don't want people to define us the way they define us as refugees. I have trying to change the narratives and change the perspectives and to educate people, to inform them and to take them on this journey with me to understand that, you know, if I want to be anywhere, I want to be with my family. And, you know, my family have sacrificed so much being away. I have sacrificed. This is not easy being a refugee, being away from your loved ones. And, you know, I'm a parent. I have a 3 years old girl and 1 year old boy. I will do anything for them to keep them safe. Like, you know, and so all of us. So we need to think in a humane terms, in a way, what do we want for our families? That's what everyone else wants. You know, we're not here queue jumping or like taking other people's jobs and opportunities and housing. Come on, you know. So as I said, like most of us are contributing and working hard. I have friends who actually buys and sells houses and rent them to British people, not just refugees or asylum seekers. So, you know, we have entrepreneurs, we have property developers. I have lots of friends, particularly like in Manchester, in Bolton, they're builders. They're building houses. I have friends who put carpets in people's houses. Like, you know, really, the society, migration is, it's life. It's part of our society. This is who we are. And we just need to, we're going to have this challenge or issue or struggle or whatever you call it. We need to deal with it in the most beautiful way possible rather than having this hostility, this hatred, as you say, the fear. Like, why? People doesn't need to fear me. I'm a normal human being. We have a lot more in common than our differences. And again, difference is not a bad thing. And I explain in The Lightless Sky, the, you know, the enemy of love is not hate, it's indifference. And we need to stop being indifferent.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, with the risk of kind of like carrying on, but that's something that really came to me from your book was the other way around, right? So you had to learn more about like Western culture. So same way as people in this country don't understand Afghan culture or people from other countries. Well, you had to do the same, didn't you? And there's lots of times in the book where people would say things or do in a certain way, and you were like, oh no, we, you know, like, I don't think that's right. And you had a real journey of learning back the other way. So everything that you're asking people to do, you've also done, haven't you? Like,
that's a great point, Tom. You know, learning is easy and learning is difficult. I had to learn and learn a lot of things. It's like the things that you learned all your life and you have to somehow either unlearn them or forget them. It's not easy. And so I get it. I sympathize with even people who are racist. I used to have views on women, and I mean, even like the Jewish people, I used to have really anti-Semitic views. That's what I was growing up with. So to challenge that and to realize and to become friends with Jewish people, to become, I do talks in churches. I can't imagine that growing up as a child, like going to churches and synagogues and like, you know, going like really. So if I could do it, anyone could do it. You know, I grew up in a very conservative, I still have my values and views, and I still quite deeply religious. And but at the same time, it doesn't stop me respecting people. It doesn't stop me appreciating, tolerating and accepting other people's beliefs. You know, I studied philosophy and ethics at college and as well as at university, and I really enjoyed it. And I, you know, I enjoy meeting different people from different cultures, trying different food. And we got, again, as very good point, being open-minded, being open-hearted and receiving and just being, I think if you're positive about things, if you're not hateful and hurt, like not have this anxiety or fear of the refugees and asylum seekers and migrants, your life will be good. Like if you stop being racist, that will help your own lives. Don't blame us for your own problems, for your laziness or for whatever issue you have. Go blame your government, MPs and ministers and whatnot. Like, I'm not the source of your problem. In fact, I will try to help you if I could. So if there are people out there listening or hearing what we are saying, is that, you know, ultimately, like, don't blame us for your ills and your struggles. We are more in line with you than we are with the people who are telling you to blame us.
Yeah, very true. Yeah, carrying that hate around, that's gonna eat people from the inside out, right? But yeah, Gwali, that was wonderful to chat, mate. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you. Great to see you. I hope we meet in person, and I wish you well. Thank you for doing what you do and, you know, raising awareness in the podcast. And I wish you success and all the best. Have a good the rest of your week.
A big up to that Proper Mental Podcast. The Proper Mental Podcast.